Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, I think ideally what we'd like to do now, given where we find ourselves, is talk to a writer, an artist, a musician, a podcaster, and maybe a mental health advocate. And it just so happens that I have all those people in one person. Blind Boy, good morning.
What's the crack, Brendan? How are you getting on?
Good, good. And listen, you're there now. You have a podcast studio down in Limerick. And I believe you had just gone back into the office there a week ago and you were re-entering into the world. Has the re-entry stalled a little bit now?
Not particularly. So what I did is over the past 2 years of COVID and lockdown, one thing I found that was suffering the most was my capacity to create. Because I'm writing a new book at the moment, you know, and being able to write short stories and to create and use my imagination. I used to think I was thinking, wow, 2 years of isolation, fantastic. Won't that be great for my creativity? And then you realise that, no, you need to actually meet human beings and have little spontaneous interactions in order for creativity to happen. So I tried there to go, right, I'm going to get myself an office. I'm going to go into it like a 9-to-5. And I'm going to see people and live a normal life. And I was doing that for a week. And now, exactly, it's looking a bit iffy.
Funny, I would have thought that you were possibly one of those kind of more introverted people who'd be comfortable enough in a lockdown. Because I know you kind of have a history of social anxiety and agoraphobia. And that I thought that might have kicked in again and you might have been cosy enough.
Well, that's the thing. I before the pandemic, thought of myself as a completely introverted person who didn't need people and I'd be absolutely fine. And then I realised that, like, yes, I am comfortable in my own. I'm comfortable with my own company for long periods of time, but I do need social interaction. And, yeah, like you're saying there, so I did at one point in my life have a problem with agoraphobia specifically that was brought on by anxiety. And the pandemic brought some of that back for me, you know, because means when I had mental health issues, I'd be afraid to leave the house. I'd be afraid to go into a situation where there's a lot of people. But there was no reason to be afraid, if you get me. That was an irrational fear based on my anxiety. And I conquered that through counselling and whatever. And then I'm stuck back in the lockdown and the behaviours are now normal. So now it's normal to be cautious around crowds. It's normal to not want to go somewhere where there's a lot of people. So it brought back a lot of stuff for me and I had to do a good bit of work on myself, you know.
Yeah, you said an interesting thing in your podcast recently that I think a lot of people might chime with a lot of people. You said you forgot who you were in the last year and a half.
That was an interesting one. The little things I'm noticing, such as forgetting, that's a mad statement, but forgetting a little bit about who I am, because You don't take into account how much your own personality is reflected back off the people you meet. When you meet people every day and when you have the opportunity to use empathy, that's the main thing, Brendan. Like, when you open a door for someone in the morning, when you say hello to somebody, how are you getting on? You're using empathy each time you do that. And every time you use a little bit of empathy, not only are you connecting with another human being, but it kind of roots and grounds you in your own emotions. And then when that was gone, I kind of forgot who I was. And then I had a mad experience where I was in the city centre in Limerick and I hadn't really been in there properly for 2 years. Like I had, but as fleeting visits amongst the anxiety of lockdown. But this was the first time I went in there and I'm like, I'm double vaccinated. I've got my mask on. I'm no longer afraid anymore. So I started like watching and looking all around at Limerick City and I noticed little things like weeds where there were no weeds before, or signs that were all of a sudden very dirty, or walls that needed a lick of paint. And I said to myself, Jesus, it's like I've woken up from a coma. Like I was aware, I could see 2 years have passed and the city has gone into a little bit of disrepair because there's been no humans, there's been no footfall. But my brain couldn't feel like it was 2 years that was gone. Do you get me? Yeah. So my perception of time. And like I said to myself, it's like I woke up from a COVID coma.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing too how quickly things start to disintegrate as well, isn't it? In our lived environment and everything. And then, so have you got back a bit to who you were? As, like I think a lot of people have struggled over the last while with that re-entry. We've all become kind of rusty in different ways about just, you know, knowing how to be in a little group of people and stuff like that and all those kinds of things.
So it's like riding a bicycle. So I know. So I was concerned when I first, so I think it was like August, I was allowed to start doing gigs again. And I was really worried because I'm like, geez, I haven't done a gig now in 2 years. And when I first started gigging years ago, obviously I used to be anxious about getting out in front of a crowd. Like, public speaking is something that elicits anxiety in most people. And I'm also someone who's not comfortable with public speaking, but it's my job. So I have to work on that not being an issue. So I was terrified about going back to gigs. And it's mad, the stuff. Like, I forgot. I would walk out on stage and I'd forget to introduce myself. forgetting to say hello to people. Like, the brain automates everything. And COVID took that away. So the tiniest little social interactions, I nearly forgot how to get onto a bus.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't sure how to get onto a bus properly. All of that just kind of leaves.
Yeah.
But I know that the way to combat it is you don't think about it. You just go straight into the deep end. So that's one of the reasons, too, I got myself this little office, is I get up in the morning at 9 and I go in and I do a full day's work writing. And I come home then at 5 just for the sake of the routine, or just on the off chance that I might see a person and say hello to them and have those little, or even being in a shop and buying something, those small little things, what I'm looking for is emotional literacy, Brendan. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
I need to be able to understand what I'm feeling at all points. Do you know, to be able to check in with my own emotions and go, am I anxious? Am I angry? Am I frightened? Am I sad? And to know what I'm feeling at all points. And once I can have that awareness and that groundedness, then my mental health's in check. Do you get me? And then once my mental health's in check, then I can create, I can do my job.
Yeah. An interesting thing there. You had a little injury. Your Achilles tendon, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it had a huge knock-on effect on your mental health. And I think people do always underestimate, like, an injury can change life, can't it?
Oh, yeah. So throughout lockdown, the one thing I had was my running. I exercise frequently, not necessarily for the physical benefits of it, but for, it's free drugs. It's free happy brain chemicals when you exercise regularly. So the hardest thing about lockdown for me, I didn't mind that I couldn't go to a pub. I didn't particularly mind that I couldn't go to a shop, but I did mind that I couldn't go to a gym. That was really, really upsetting because, like I said, I need the gym to give myself a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, and also the simple feel-good feeling of exercising. So then I said to myself, okay, grand, no gym. I must cope. So I started running, but then I started running too much.
Yeah.
And I was running 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And then I damaged my Achilles. And the thing is, if you know yourself, if you're running, if your Achilles is damaged, that's it. You're not running. And it's only healed now after a year. But that's when my mental health started to slip. That's when I started to wake up in the mornings with extreme sense of dread for no reason. That's always a sign when your mental health isn't great. Waking up with an extreme sense of dread, then being anxious, then entertaining paranoid thoughts, all of this stuff.
Okay. Does it spiral quite quickly for you, yeah?
No, because I have tools. So I know one of the skills that I've learned over the year through access to counselling and through regularly keeping my mental health in check, I know the earliest warning signs. The earliest warning signs for me, it can be as simple as ignoring emails. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not ignoring the email because I'm too busy. It's the email comes in and it makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I know I should answer the email because it's important. But then a defense mechanism kicks in and that defense mechanism has me ignoring the email. So now what's happening is that there's an important email in my inbox and that's not getting answered.
And it's getting bigger.
So then 24 hours kicks in and now it's become a real problem. But then I start using more and more defense mechanisms to pretend that that problem isn't happening. And then all of a sudden now I'm not cleaning up after myself because the stress, here's the thing with stress and anxiety. And here's the thing about the earliest signs of mental health issues for me when they do kick in. If I'm waking up in the morning with a sense of dread, that sense of the first thing you do is you go, oh no, everything's terrible, or I'm a bad person, or you have a feeling of shame or a feeling of, you don't know what it is, it's just this horrible feeling waking up. Once that happens, that kicks your brain into fight, flight or freeze, basically. The emotional center of your brain is fully engaged, and when that happens, you don't have access to the critical parts of your brain. So you go about your day in a heightened sense of fear or anger. You're quite reactionary. And that's then when you start ignoring emails and doing little things like that. Because the critical part of my brain says, that email's important, you better answer that. Or the critical part of my brain says, you better clean up those dishes, because if you don't, you'll create a problem for yourself and then your kitchen will be dirty. But when I'm experiencing mental health issues, that critical part of my brain isn't being accessed. The part of my brain that understands my own emotions isn't being accessed. And that's when things go on a bad spiral for me.
And it's just everything telling you it's too much. I can't do that. Yeah, yeah.
And after about a month of that, if I do that solid for a month with no intervention, then I'll get an actual panic attack. And then once I start getting panic and anxiety attacks, about a month after that, then I start to get what I'd call proper depression. So the skills I've learned over the years, it never gets to that point. I always tend to stay around the not answering emails part. And then I can spot that as a red flag. And that's when I start doing my grounding work. That's when I start meditating. That's when I start saying to myself, hold on a minute now. You've been anxious all day long. You're reactionary to other people. I'm seeing threats where they don't exist. I'm seeing insults where insults don't exist. And I sit down and I ground myself, which means I very simply check in with my body. I silently breathe. I breathe in such a way that I'm breathing in through my nose and I feel my stomach expanding. So I'm bringing in a huge amount of oxygen when I do that. And then I just notice my feet. I notice my ankles. I notice my knees. And I'm literally checking in with being physically present and alive. And what that does is it takes all the stress hormones down. And now I can think critically again. And now, because I'm breathing, I'm going, yeah, that email does need to get answered. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And then I start to say to myself, maybe the person who I didn't respond to, maybe they don't mind, maybe they'll understand. And all this critical, reasonable, rational thinking comes in and I take myself back.
Interesting that it's all kicked off by doing something physical initially. Come here, can I ask you... So you had this agoraphobia as a kid or whatever. How did all this cycle start for you? Like, what kind of a young fellow were you?
Well, that's a lot of mental health issues kick in at about 19 or 20, I find, right? And for me, it was simply the terror of having to be being an adult. That's a very frightening thing. You spend your whole life in school with people doing everything for you, everything regimented, and then all of a sudden you're thrust out into the world. And you're almost terrified by the freedom of it. You know what I mean? The freedom of choice. When the world says to you, you are now an adult and you have to stand on your own two feet and you have to get a job and you have to pay bills. The terror of that, I wasn't ready for it. And it ended up with me just being afraid of everything then as a result, you know? But I think if I traced it back to my childhood, I used to have asthma as a child, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I went through this now in therapy. I used to have asthma as a child. And my dad would have been a little bit anxious too, prone to anxiety. And the doctor would have said to my dad, oh, he's got asthma now, which means that if he overexerts himself, he might get an asthma attack and die. Now, the chances of that were very small. But my dad would have heard, oh, he's going to die if he goes out and plays soccer and runs around. Is that what's going to happen? So my dad was kind of cautious around that, and I learned a message from a young age that if you play soccer, you might get an asthma attack and die. Or if you have a sleepover at your friend's gaff, you won't have your nebulizer with you and you might get an asthma attack and die. But I, as a child, because I'm a little child and I'm not thinking critically and I'm not questioning the messaging from the adults, I would have internalized that as if you behave normally like other people your own age, you may die. And then that manifests as panic attacks where literally I feel like I'm dying. Now that took years of access to therapy to be able to get to that point to realize that that's where I came from, you know. And I got therapy in college. because I wouldn't have been able to afford a psychotherapist normally. But when I was in college, I got 3 years of weekly free counselling, CBT, Gestalt therapy, all this stuff, which still stands to me today. So it's why as well it's so important to have access to services for people who need them, not to have these giant waiting lists, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Because look, the cost in the long run is much, much more, as we both know. It's interesting that it wasn't like any obvious major childhood trauma. It was actually like your dad maybe trying to do the right thing by you, but it just shows the little things that with the parenting is such a minefield, like that you're trying to do the right thing. Yeah.
Here's the thing, Brendan. Having mental health issues is perfectly normal. It's like having geez, you ended up with panic attacks and you didn't have any big trauma as a child. It's like, yeah, of course. This is like, we all get abscesses in our teeth, or we all sprain our ankles at some point. And mental health issues, that's just part of the tapestry of being human, you know? Life is mad.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the experience of being alive is quite profound, and especially when you start thinking on an existential level and you start to go, hold on a minute, what is this? What am I? What is consciousness? What is being alive? A lot of these things are they're triggering to everybody. Everyone has that moment in their life where you sit back and go, oh my God, what is all of this? And then you get overwhelmed with anxiety.
Is this where the plastic bag over the head comes from? Like, is that your armor?
The plastic bag over the head really is just, I like being an artist. So I like making my weekly podcast. I like writing my books. I love doing all these things, but I like using social media, but I don't like my work then bleeding into my personal life, whereby I'm being recognized in Aldi, you know? And I think too, that wouldn't suit my mental health. I'm not the type of person who would do well with being recognized and stuff. That would be quite challenging and triggering for me. Some people are all right with it. Some people enjoy being noticed and enjoy things like that. I don't. Mm. The other thing too is, in my weekly podcast, I do about one mental health podcast a month. And I speak quite honestly and candidly about my own vulnerability. Like I'm talking about there, being comfortable saying things like, I experience anxiety, or saying something like, sometimes I'm insecure, sometimes I'm jealous of other people. All of these vulnerable emotions, and I feel okay expressing these on my podcast. But the thing is, my podcast has got like just nearly 1 million people a month listening to it. So that means if I was to walk around Limerick City or up in Dublin, I'd have people stopping me on the street and they'd be saying, that thing you said this morning on your podcast. And I'd need to give people quite a lot of emotional space in order to have those conversations. Like mental health conversations, I know this because it happens to people like Brezzy. Like Brezzy could be out having a pint and then someone will come up and really share with him something from their lives, you know? And you have to be fully present for that person. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, sorry, I'm just running out the door. If someone opens up to you, you really have to listen. So if I didn't have this bag, I think that would be happening to me quite a bit in a public sphere. And I don't think I'd have the emotional tools or the emotional energy to be able to do that. And I might even be rude to someone. I might listen to the first two people and then I'm rude to the third person. Yeah. And I'd hate that to happen.
Yeah. But then I imagine it must have got more difficult down the years to keep that distinction there, because I suppose, you know, when I would have first become aware of you, the blind boy thing was very much, it was very much a character. But the blind boy has become more and more sincere now and more you. So now, so you have that on one hand, this person that is you that wears the bag and does the public stuff. But presumably this is pretty close to who you are in your own private life with your friends and everything else as well.
Yeah, that's something I started doing over the years, just becoming more sincere. And people, that's where social media has moved towards as well. Social media and podcasts, people listen to podcasts because of something called a parasocial relationship. So it's not necessarily pure entertainment. People listen to a podcast because if you think of our lives, right, and you think of the amount of noise that's simply created by having a phone in your hand all day, right? Mm. When you're nonstop flicking through Instagram, flicking through Facebook, flicking through the news, that's a lot of information all the time, and it's actually quite draining. And we don't find a lot of spaces in our day to not be looking at our phone and to simply relax. And podcasts provide that space for a lot of people. If you're listening to a podcast and you're truly engaged in it, you're not scrolling through your phone. That's your little bit of mindful peace. But the thing is that people, the podcast that you listen to, the person starts to feel as if they are a friend. Do you get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that's where entertainment has gone now. It's parasocial relationships with people. So because of that, then I kind of have to be a bit more authentic and a bit more honest with my emotions and a bit real with people, because they'll spot it if you're not.
You had an interesting chat recently on, I think it was the fourth anniversary of the podcast, right? And you started this podcast at the time when you put your first book out, and it was to sell your book and everything. But obviously, as you were saying, it's become really successful. But
yeah, I didn't think I'd go past four episodes. Like,
yeah, but you point out that for you, it's been a way as an artist and as a creative to have an income, which is something that you never really had as an artist.
So I'm 20 years doing this. Like I started when I was in school, and the first 10 years of trying to be an entertainer were completely unpaid. That's often what a lot of people have to do, making work nonstop, hoping that it hits and not receiving any payment. And then once you become professional, we'll say, and that would have happened for me in about 2010 around Horse Outside. Now I'm professional, and I might get to make one documentary a year or for TV, or I might get to do a couple of gigs. But being an artist today, your income is consistently uncertain. You don't know where your money's coming from. You don't know if you're doing well now, will you be doing well in a month? So with my podcast, I have a Patreon system, which means that people who listen to my podcast, they don't necessarily, I don't charge people to listen to the podcast. What I say to people is that if you're listening to this and you like it and you enjoy it, you can give me the price of a pint once a month on Patreon to pay me for the work I'm doing. And if you can't afford it, don't worry about it. You listen for free, and the other people are paying for you to listen for free. But what that's done is that that's given me certainty around my income. I know exactly how much I'm going to get each month, and then I can, it's like a real job.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say about the creative life and everything, that basically you make no money. Because obviously you were nearly going to become a psychologist, I think, at one point. And I suppose there's an argument you kind of became one class of a psychologist. But so is choosing an artistic and creative kind of life, is that in a way accepting that you're not going to be able to have a mortgage, have kids, all that stuff? Do you have to be willing to give all that up?
So I didn't do that. What I did is I said to myself, I love being an artist and I really want to try this, but the chances of failure are absolutely massive. So the bag also helped me with that, because it meant that I could, if I was stuck, I could just do a job and no one knows who I am. I could do a normal job. I did a couple of stints working in bars. I went back and did a master's degree. I never put my eggs in one basket. So I always had a plan B, because you can never be sure. And the thing is, my podcast is doing well now. Someone could flick a switch in Facebook or Twitter tomorrow and podcasts disappear, you know? So I don't know, will I be working in a year's time? But if I'm not, I'll just go back to college. I'll do something different. For me, what's important is living my life with meaning. And I define success as getting up in the morning and in the daytime doing what it is you love, and for that to be the thing that pays your income. So right now, that's what I have. I love making my podcast and I love writing, and my bills are getting paid. So that to me is success. I feel like that's success.
Okay, well, you're a lucky man then. Listen, before you go, Blind Boy, can I ask you, I won't drag you into now giving a load of political commentary on everything that's going on in the world, but there's something I thought you might have an understanding of the dynamics of this. It does feel to me a little bit as if what we're seeing now happening around Europe with protests and rubber bullets in Rotterdam last night and everything, is the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated, and I suppose fed by the internet, is this turning into the new big culture war, do you think, and like splitting people and dividing the social fabric and all that kind of thing?
So anytime I hear, we'd say, that specific conversation that you're mentioning there, and it doesn't have to be a vax versus anti-vax, it could be left versus right, it's whatever people are fighting about and becoming very, very divided and tribal about online. One thing I like to look at when you start looking at who's right or who's wrong, that's when you end up back in that circle. where you're like, I don't know what to make of this. So what I prefer to look at instead and is look at where conversations are happening these days, right? So you take a platform like Twitter in particular, and Facebook is similar. But something has happened over the past 10 years where we as a society have decided that really, really important conversations that are quite emotional for people, are now happening on a website like Twitter. But the thing is with Twitter, Twitter is controlled by billionaires and it's specifically geared to harvest as much data from us as possible. So it may, if you're on any website, loads, your data is what is paying for that. You're the product there. So they're earning money from your data. And your data is basically every piece of information you put into your phone, whether it's your location, where you've been that day, what you've been searching, all of this stuff is your data and it's very valuable. So social media companies have made it in such a way that they call it, in the social media companies, they refer to it as high arousal emotions. Mm. So social media companies want people at all times to be fearful or angry, because what that does is it keeps us on our phones for the longest period possible. So now
whichever side of the culture wars you're on, we're all just pawns in the game, really.
We're essentially pawns. Your data has gone out there. So with Twitter, it's like, imagine saying, you two people can have a very important conversation, but you must do it on our terms. And our terms are, it has to be on a tightrope with a bunch of people laughing and awarding points for each comment that you give. Like Twitter is a video game where you compete to have the best complaint. See, it's hard to have authentic. That's what it is. It's hard to have authentic conversations because your data is being mined when you do it.
Okay. Blind boy, great to talk to you. Enjoy
that. Thank you, Brendan.
Yeah, thanks a million. We'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.